Today is Friday, June 1st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard, sitting in for Jim Stevenson here in Washington. Coming up ahead this half hour, the U.S.-North Korean diplomatic dance continues, helping Asian American women struggling with depression in silence and putting gravity to work for power here on Earth. It's all on today's VOA Asia. We begin today with the latest on the on, then off, then maybe on again, U.S.-North Korean summit in June. Speaking on the White House lawn today, President Trump seemed to indicate that the switch is now set to on.
He's meeting again today. I believe they'll be coming down to Washington on Friday, and a letter is going to be delivered to me from Kim Jong-un. So I look forward to seeing what's in the letter, but it's very important to them. So they'll be probably coming down to Washington, D.C. on Friday for the delivery of a letter. I look forward to that.
Joining us now is White House Bureau Chief for VOA, Steve Herman. Steve, I'm confused. This summit has been on, it's been off. Now we don't seem to really know what's going on. There are meetings going on today. Help us understand where exactly we are with this.
It is on again, but whether, Doug, it is actually going to happen on June 12th remains to be seen. That's the goal for both the United States and North Korea. And President Trump today said there probably needs to be more than one meeting. So even if it is held on June 12th, there are now lower expectations that there will be some sort of monumental deal done on North Korean denuclearization.
We just heard a clip from President Trump today saying that he expects meetings Friday in Washington, and that he's expecting a letter, apparently, from Kim Jong-un in response to President Trump's letter to Kim Jong-un. What difference can a letter make?
Well, this president very much enjoys ceremony and flattery. And having a letter signed by the leader of North Korea, especially if it uses positive and conciliatory language, I think can be quite significant and influential.
Over the last 20 years, as I reflect on it, and of course I'm no North Korea scholar, but it seems that the government there blows, pardon me for saying this, hot and cold at times.
Yes.
Sometimes they seem to be extending the hand, and other times they seem to be raising the fist. Presently, they're extending the hand. Is there any sense that perhaps this just may be a prelude to a fist or another sudden kind of change from the government?
That's always the concern with North Korea, that it could very quickly go back to quite hostile rhetoric coming out of Pyongyang. But there are some reports that Kim Jong-un has admonished the foreign ministry in Pyongyang for taking that more insulting tone that caused President Trump to say that the meeting on June 12th was off.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a sea change? We don't know. But what does seem really remarkable is this discussion over denuclearization and what that would actually mean. According to the United States, it has to be complete, verifiable, and irreversible. But North Korea may have a completely different definition of denuclearization, which to them might mean removing all U.S. military assets from South Korea. So we really haven't seen clearly what is going to be put on the table if Trump and Kim do meet on June 12th.
Well, I hope you had no vacation plans for the next 2 weeks. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Doug.
And we invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia. And, of course, you can visit our website, voanews.com. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. China to host Iranian President Rouhani now that the U.S. has pulled out of the nuclear deal. Israel bars Indonesian tourists after Indonesia bans Israelis. Growing threats of a U.S.-China trade war on the horizon. And Pakistan mulls blocking U.S. supply lines into Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. In Myanmar's Karen State, more than 2,000 former displaced persons have been uprooted once again after government troops violated a 2015 ceasefire agreement by entering territory controlled by the ethnic armed group, all in order to construct a military road. More than 60 years of civil war between the Karen National Union and the Myanmar Army has left more than 100,000 Karen refugees in camps along the Thai-Myanmar border. Steve Sanford talks to those in Karen State's conflict zone affected by the renewed fighting.
Here in the remote village of Cabro Banta, food and water are shared between the locals and many of their relatives who have expectedly arrived. 16 years ago, Nemo Dewa was shot in the stomach by Myanmar soldiers as she was fleeing a battle in a nearby cornfield. After a 2015 ceasefire agreement was signed, hopes for a safe return home were shattered when fighting resumed in March after soldiers entered the territory.
After the ceasefire, I thought the situation was getting better. We decided to come back to our own home, our own land, but the situation got worse. We have to flee from our own village again.
Ongoing displacement has left thousands of people at risk of disease as the rainy season arrives, along with the added danger of getting caught in the crossfire. Satu Sewa's brother-in-law, a leading activist fighting to preserve ancestral land for returning refugees, was killed by the Myanmar army during the fighting.
I think they signed the ceasefire because they want to build the road cutting through our land. They came to tell us, but we don't want them to build the road. We can't do anything because we're just small villagers and we can't resist them.
14 dams are planned to be built along the Salween River, but most of the electricity is set to be sold outside the country. It's a plan that doesn't sit well with Karen aid groups, who see the developments as the root of the problems, with little or no local benefits.
The Burmese army wanted to build mega development project in our area. And in order to build development project in our area, they need to increase the security by sending in more troops, building the roads.
Karen National Union official Pado Kwe Tuwin says the Myanmar army has now agreed to temporarily stop road construction and allow villagers back to the area. But the KNU chairperson quickly added that the Karen will need confirmation on the ground to see if this actually happens. VOA was unsuccessful in its attempts to get comment from Myanmar's government. Steve Sanford reporting for VOA News from Karen State, Myanmar.
Happening now in Asia, in a largely symbolic move aimed at reflecting new national priorities, the Pentagon is changing the name of the Pacific Command to the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. This comes amid mounting strains with China regarding their military-naval posture in the South China Sea. Stay up to date with VOA and keep it tuned to VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. Asian American women aged 18 to 24 have the nation's second highest suicide rate among women in that age group. That shocking statistic comes from research from Boston University Associate Professor Hyuk Chris Ham. Asian American women, Ham says, often have to straddle two worlds, as do their parents. Her research has led to a new intervention program to get young women the help that they need. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Professor Ham, who told him that the struggles of the parents are often visited on the children.
These are all the perceived parents' struggles from these women, okay? His parents have multiple social, cultural, contextual problems. For example, his parents, majority of the parents, have either mental health or physical health problems, and they also have the marital discord, meaning that they are not necessarily divorced, but they are having, you know, such a high marital stress, distress, or problems, but they are living together. And his parents also have a linguistic problems and job-related stresses. It doesn't matter how much income they have, how much money they bring into their household, regardless of their job or socioeconomic status, parents were going through a lot of job stresses.
Are most of these women, young women, students or just the overall population?
They were overall. So the thing, my study, we collected 730 Asian American women between age between 18 to 35 years old, and we conducted quantitative and qualitative study. So the ABCDG parenting framework, actually that came from the qualitative data analysis. But we have published so many. We have actually published more than about 15 articles analyzing these 730 women, quantitative and qualitative data. So there were unmarried women and women who are living in Massachusetts.
Okay. Then you went and started an outreach, I understand, at Wellesley. Is that correct or what?
Okay. So what happened was that after we have collected this incredible information and deepened our understanding of their mental health problems, we realized that, you know what, these women need to develop an intervention specifically for these women. Because when we also wanted to find out, okay, if these women are depressed, are they going to psychotherapy? Are they utilizing specific mental health treatment? The answer was no. What we have found was that the highest risk, the very high risk mental health problems, women with mental health problems, only one in three of these high risk mental health women was going to treatment.
Is there a dividing line between Eastern and Western culture here? Do you believe that the same holds true for young women in China, in the rest of Asia?
That's a really interesting question. I think what happens is that there are some similar things that aware intervention touches on. The expectation toward Asian American women, okay, and the expectation toward Chinese women, there are some similarities. The similarity is that the society expects them to behave in a certain way, okay? And the household, the parents, expect them to bring certain things. And also this cultural aspect that there is a super achievement, you know, that success-driven culture. China is a very much success-driven culture. Korea is a very success-driven culture. So nowadays, students have to work even harder, but they work very, very hard. But at the same time, they feel like so many other amazing people are out there. So that is a really, really difficult thing.
Boston University's Hyuk Chris Ham speaking with our Ira Melman.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Mm-hmm. this news alert from VOA Asia. Iran is threatening to give petroleum giant Total stake in its South SARS gas field to China if the French company cannot secure protections from U.S. nuclear-related sanctions. Officials in Tehran are giving Total 60 days to negotiate protection from U.S. sanctions. Otherwise, it will give the China National Petroleum Company controlling interest in the field. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. Between 50 and 80% of urban employment in the global south is in what researchers call the informal economy. Now, this can be everything from home-based work to street vendors to recycling pickers and many others in between. For example, in the Indian city of Ahmedabad, fully 85% of workers in these informal sectors. Often these workers are dismissed, harassed, or treated as less than. But a new study from the World Resources Institute puts forward a series of changes that cities could implement to treat these urban workers as, well, urban workers. Marty Chen of Harvard's Kennedy School is a co-author of the report. Professor Chen, now you describe as the what you describe as the informal economy, frankly, sounds what 200 or 100 years ago was what we just called the economy.
You're right, but since 60 to 80% of the urban workforce in the global south, at least, is informally employed. It's a goal that has to be pursued. Otherwise, we're going to have such a clash of gated communities, elite residential areas, formal firms, surrounded by a sea of people trying to earn their livelihoods under great odds. So it needs to be tackled, and some parts of what we're talking about is reducing current negative practices. So doing that doesn't involve a lot of extra budgetary expenditure. It involves changing mindsets so that these workers are seen to be predominantly working poor persons trying to earn an honest living under great odds.
Explain for us what you mean by this term, informal economy.
Thanks for asking. What the informal economy refers to all economic activities, units, and workers who are not both regulated but also protected by the state. Informal workers are defined, those who are informally employed, are defined as those who do not get social protection through their work. And informal enterprises are defined as enterprises that are not legally incorporated or registered. So there's informal enterprises, and then there's these informal jobs, and the two add up to the informal economy.
If you were to identify some of the kinds of work that people are doing in this informal economy, let's for example focus on Southeast Asia. What kind of examples are we talking about?
Well, the one that people know because they're most visible and people run into them are the street vendors. But there are also informal traders who are in little kiosks or built markets. So informal people who work in informal trade, the day laborers in construction. I've just come back from Asia, and you can see the recruitment corners as you drive through cities. So the construction day laborers, there are in manufacturing, a lot of workers in manufacturing are in small workshops and a large percent in their homes, their own homes. South Asia and Southeast Asia are known for having large numbers of home-based producers. And a country like India, which I know well, 36% of all units, all enterprises, all businesses, however you want to call them, in India are home-based.
It sounds to me a little bit like what you describe as today's informal economy was, depending on the region, 300, maybe 200 years ago, simply the economy.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is that it's remained the economy in the global south. And then we have an overlay in the global south of what's called the formal economy. But many of those economies didn't go through the sort of industrial revolution with mass production and big factories.
So how is it that you would propose that cities or maybe regions, to think of it better, can leapfrog over that as yet to happen, you know, transition to a formal economy to really give these workers, these millions and millions of workers, more stability, more of a sense of security?
Well, the first step is to say they probably are not going to get formal jobs because not enough formal jobs are being created, and we've got a huge pool of unemployed youth who would want those formal jobs. The second is to say that these informal workers are, through their various occupations, contributing to the economy. They're legitimate economic actors.
Harvard University's Marty Chen, and you're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia: Malaysians have contributed nearly $2 million to a special fund to help that nation's financial situation. The donations come as more details about the scandal at State Investment Fund 1MDB become clearer. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. In today's energy-hungry world, scientists are constantly looking for ways to increase efficiency. One researcher believes even gravity can be harnessed to produce free electricity. VOA's George Pudich has more.
When exposed to mechanical stress, certain materials such as quartz crystals and some ceramics produce tiny amounts of electricity. This effect, called piezoelectricity, is used in barbecue lighters to create a spark that lights up the flame. It is also used to create audio signals in crystal phono cartridges and crystal microphones. But piezoelectricity only works when the applied force changes from pressure to release and back. Gravity, on the other hand, is a constant force.
The problem with gravity is that it's always pushing in one manner.
Dutch architect Jan-Jaap Rosenaars noticed that when a long vertical pole attached to a base plate is pushed out of balance, it tends to wobble for a long time, applying intermittent pressure on the edges of the base plate.
So the actual invention that you're looking at here, the gravity energy device, is introducing change. So once gravity is being transformed into a changing thing, then you can generate electricity, and that's what you're seeing here.
Piezoelectric material inserted between the wobbling base plate and the solid ground is exposed to constantly increasing and relaxing pressure, thus creating electricity.
With very little input, we get instability in this system. Gravity takes over.
The wobbling of the pole can be produced even when the hot air created by a lamp starts turning a small rotor on its top.
It's really so new that we still have to discover what is the most optimal, but it's indefinite or infinite, basically, how many piezo material you can add to it.
Rosenaars says the same principle could be applied on a larger scale for charging car batteries or in standalone electricity generators. George Pudich, VOA News.
And you've been listening to VOA Asia. Make sure to follow us at VOA Asia Facebook. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Enjoy the weekend.